Hey, y'all, how's it going? Happy New Year. Brand new year, same old me. Same old intro music. All right. Got a good one lined up for you today. Mark Thornton, who's the... I forgot what he is now. Is he the... He's the something. He's a senior fellow. Maybe more than that now at the Mises Institute. I forget. Anyway, more on the drug wars with the great Mark Thornton. And then also Frank Ledwidge. He's, well, he's all kinds of things. I better queue up that email that he sent me here. Did I mention to you guys how I had read this? Oh, I mentioned it to Eric Margolies. That's what happened. I was talking with Eric Margolies last week. And I says to Eric Margolies, I says, hey, I was reading this thing at the London Review of Books, and it was all about these five different books about the Afghan War. And then remember, I spaced out and forgot what my question was for a minute, and then I remembered it. It wasn't that good a one, but anyway. Point is, this guy emails me, and he says, hey, I wrote one of the books that you were referring to in your question to Margolies there, and I listened to your show, so that's why I heard that. And, hey, I want to come on your show and talk about some things. So I says to him, I says, okay. And, yeah, he's got a huge bio here. First-hand experience working for the British government in every war since Bosnia in 1996, he says. Military intelligence. So that's going to be interesting. I'm pretty sure. What I read about him in this... London Review of Books piece, I think will make for a good basis for first part of this interview anyway. Okay, so that should be good. And then, you remember Belle True? She came on, I forget now whether we talked about Gaza or if I just read her and followed her on Twitter about Gaza, but I certainly interviewed her back, say, I don't know, half a year ago or something like that, on the subject of the civil war in Libya. And she's got a great new piece for foreignpolicy.com that came out 2 days ago, 3 days ago, all about the civil war in Libya. It's the most I've come to learn about it. That's for sure. So got quite a few questions to talk with Belle about there, so that should be good. Belle True. What a cool name, right? Belle True. All right, Mark Thornton, Frank Ledwidge, Belle True, today on the show. By the way, if you like me and you like hearing me interview folk, you should know that you could sign up for the podcast feeds. There are two different ones. There's one that's the whole show archives. There's also just the interviews, as it's called. And you can find those on Stitcher and at iTunes, of course, and FeedBurner and whatever. And I don't know. I think I need better links at the top of my page. But anyway, you can figure out how to sign up for the podcast feeds there. Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org. That's where I keep all the stuff. ScottHorton.org/interviews for the archive. More than 3,500 now. More than 3,600 now. Although, I don't think I can really round up by, you know, each hundred. I think I gotta stick to 500s. Once you're over 3,000 interviews, then I don't think you can really update it until you make another 500 mark. And so, more than 3,500 interviews now there at scotthorton.org. Oh, and I'm sorry I sound funny. I have a bit of a up. Actually, I probably sound better. I have a deeper voice today. I have a upper respiratory thing in my thing, but I'm trying to drink some tea here and wash it away. But, you know, the wife brought home some pretty good medicine from the Walgreens there. I think it's kicking in. I'm feeling all right. Huh? Okay. You know what? I got some news to cover before these interviews start. I got very little time for this segment, but I can certainly fit this in. Settlers throw stones at U.S. consulate convoy in the West Bank. So what happened was these settler thugs went and destroyed some Palestinians' olive trees, as they are wont to do. being, you know, terrorists and everything. Ooh, doesn't that hurt people's feelings if you call terrorism terrorism when it's Israelis doing it? Anyway, so the Americans, for some reason, did Obama call this shot? Did John Kerry call this shot? Who called this shot? The Americans sent a consulate convoy to the West Bank to go and investigate the report of the destroyed Palestinian olive tree groves. And so then when they showed up, all the West Bank colonists, that is, land rustlers, that is, thieves, who get paid with the money taken straight out of your paycheck to go and steal land from Palestinians, they started throwing rocks at the American State Department officials. According to Israeli police, the accompanying American security personnel did not use their weapons during the incident. However, a settler from Adi Ad, if that's how you say it, who asked not to be named, told Reuters that at least two security guards drew their weapons. One had a pistol, the other an M16, and they pointed them at the settlers. He was quoted as saying, Army Radio also reported that one security guard brandished his firearm. Rocks were thrown at them, said the Israeli police. We are investigating. Arrests have yet to be made. The U.S. has yet to issue a statement on the event. Well, I'm waiting. I'm sure that just like in the case of Rachel Corrie and Furkan Dogan and what's her name, the lady that lost her eyeball in that protest in the West Bank about a year and a half ago, that the State Department will say nothing, do nothing, and will refuse to stick up even for their own employees, right? Because, hey, it's the Israelis. They can do whatever they want, right? That's called a special relationship. That's called exceptionalism. Stealing isn't wrong if you're an Israeli. Hey, stealing isn't wrong if you're a New Yorker on the dole over there stealing Palestinian land for Israelis. Oh, no, then it's perfectly fine. And hey, assault and battery on a State Department official, that's not a problem. Throwing a stone at the head of a State Department official, why, that's not a crime if you're an Israeli who's in the middle of stealing land and burning down the olive tree groves of people whose land you haven't stolen all of it yet, you know, all of it. Whose land you haven't completed the theft of at the time, then it's perfectly fine, right? Like when the IDF crushed Rachel Corrie to death with their Caterpillar bulldozer. Like when the IDF shot Furkan Dogan 9 times at point blank range on the Mavi Marmara. Who cares if he's an American-born American citizen? With a name like that, he's some kind of foreigner, right? And an Israeli IDF killer is way more American than an actual American citizen who dies at his hand. I don't know why, but those are the rules. And anyway, so it'll be fun to see whether the State Department even has something to say about this at all. Are they just going to maintain no comment? What channel? Is it C-SPAN 3? Where can I watch the State Department briefing today? Are they even going to mention this? Well, we frown upon having stones thrown at our head by Israeli land rustlers. And we condemn that in very uncertain terms, in the softest possible terms that we regret. And yes, you're right, are anti-Semitic. Sorry. Is that the State Department spokesman statement today? Are we going to get a comment at all from them? John Kerry going to lay down on his belly on TV? You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So let's see. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. No way, huh? Really? Yeah, so 8 years. That's what I thought, but then I thought, man, that doesn't sound right. I better count on my fingers. Yeah, it's been 8 years since I started doing The Daily Show. I've been doing a weekend show, the weekend interview show, throughout 2004, 5, and whatever. And in 2006, I did the Chaos Report on Chaos Radio here in Austin, but I didn't really have much of an interview show because I just didn't have the technology hooked up. I did about 3 interviews in 2006, I think, unfortunately. Very important year for history, too. But then starting the very end of 06 with Ron Paul and Robert Dreyfus, and then really getting going in January of 2007. That's when I started doing The Daily Show, Anti-War Radio for Antiwar.com, and then eventually here for the Liberty Radio Network. So, cool. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to stop any wars or anything like that, but then again, I never really believed that I would be able to. The point of the show is really just to provide a place for you guys to come to find the truth. And that, to me, is what talk radio is all about, is book recommendations, right? That's why I love talk radio, is because anybody can, well, presumably not so much on this show, but you know what I mean. Pick up a phone and recommend a book to a city full of people. Hey, everybody, have you ever read this or that? Yeah, you might like it. That, to me, is the point of radio. So that's why, as you notice, the people that I interview on the show, I don't, except for Eric Margolies, who I know is good on everything, and if I need to talk to him about something, I know that he can deliver. Other than that, almost, and even then, but most of the time I go by the article written, the actual substance, rather than the individual expert guest or whatever. Because that's what it's all about, is trying to get you to read what I read and thought was important. That's the show. And then hopefully we won't have to live in a world of crap and lies and BS. At least we won't all have to. Now, I don't know. I think it's the spotlight. Was it? I get my days confused now. Yeah, it's the spotlight today on Antiwar.com. It's Glenn Greenwald's piece. The Sony story shows how eagerly U.S. media regurgitate government claims. And that's what I was pointing out was the most important part of the entire Sony story, was that they never had any even good reason to believe that North Korea did it. But once the government claimed it, that was good enough for virtually the entire American media to pick it up and run with it. And then you heard me kind of wondering out loud on the show last week, how many Americans bought that? I mean, is that really working on you people or what, you know? And then Glenn cited a thing, says 3/4 of the American people consider North Korea a threat. Oh, really? Because they hacked a Japanese movie company, electronics company. That makes them a threat to you? Or to what? Or do you know what the word threat means? Or it doesn't matter. TV said, be upset about this. And so it's always going to be that way. But I'm an individualist. So I'm just trying to provide a place where individuals can come in case they want a breath of fresh air when it comes to that kind of thing. You probably could have heard all about how North Korea did it on Fresh Air. But so that's why I'm here. Okay. Yeah. I never believed it, so I never told you to believe it. Isn't that funny how that works? I bet none of y'all believed it, right? North Korea hacked Sony. Why would they do that? Why would I believe a thing just because you guys tell it to me? All right. So anyway, there we go. 8 years. 8 years straight now of The Daily Show, but no, really since 2003. So that would be 12 years of Scott Horton interview shows of one kind or the other here, mostly debunking war propaganda. And I've been giving it all away for free this whole time, too, as far as all the archives go. pretty much anybody giving away or anybody who has extensive audio archives charges for them, but not me. In fact, back on the old Philip Drew site, it said, no rights reserved. Go ahead. You can have them. So I'm happy to do that. I'm also happy to get donations at the door for those of you who like to help support. And I know I need to set it up better where it's a subscription. You should do a yearly subscription to the show. I don't know, a monthly subscription. Whatever. Pay what you like. Go to scotthorton.org/donate if you want to help support the show. I sure would appreciate it. You know I'm good on all of this stuff. And as the wars continue to rage on, you're going to need a place to go to find out the truth about all this, right? So here I am. ScottHorton.org/donate. But more importantly, first and foremost, really, I need advertisers. I got some. I need more. That would really help. And I'd be more than happy to, you know, give something in return for your monthly subscriptions. If you pay me enough, and if you have something for me to advertise, say a peace group of some kind or another, or a small business, or a large business, let me know. I'll cut some spots. We'll see if we can get rid of some stuff. It'll be great. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. And you know who you are. If you think you got a boss you could convince to help support, if you are the boss and you think it's about time, then you think it's worth it. You notice that this show is a little bit different than other ones you've heard before, and you appreciate that about it, help support. ScottHorton.org/donate or ScottHorton.org/support to find out all the information there. And again, my email address is scott@scotthorton.org. I work cheap. We'll work it out. It'll be great. Okay, cool. All right, so interviews coming up. Like I said, Mark Thornton, Frank Ledwidge, and Bell True all coming up on the show. More Israel news here real quick, other than them throwing stones at the State Department, which who hasn't wanted to throw stones at the State Department sometimes? It's just when it's a contest between Israeli land rustler racial colonists, you know, terrorizing the people of the West Bank and destroying their property and then throwing stones at Americans. Nah, I side with the Americans. I don't know. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I side with the Americans, even though they're government employees. Although the whole crisis is the American State Department's fault in the first place, right? If Barack Obama, well, and the Congress too, it'd take the American people, really, but even the president could do it. If they just said, hey, we're not picking up your tab anymore, the Israeli government would have to get out of the West Bank. It's that that same sovereign immunity that the cops get, that the Israelis get. It's their license to kill, granted by the U.S. Empire. Without it, they'd have to get the hell out of there. Anyway, so the Palestinians are trying to join the International Criminal Court. And I just love this. The State Department, same State Department that just got stones thrown at their skulls. They're deeply troubled by this provocative act. What sort of provocation is this that the Palestinians would try to join the International Criminal Court, where then they could try to file criminal charges against the Israeli government for, you know, murdering them, violating international law? What are you trying to say, that Israel isn't exceptional? That Israelis aren't born with the right to murder whoever they want and steal whatever they want? What madness is this? Cries the U.S. State Department. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. First show of the new year here. I'm Scott Horton on the Liberty Radio Network. ScottHorton.org for the archives. At Scott Horton Show on Twitter. First up today is our friend Mark Thornton. He is senior fellow at the Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. He's the book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. His publications include The Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War, The Quotable Mises, The Bastiat Collection, An Essay on Economic Theory, and The Bastiat Reader. And, boy, it goes on and on and on like this for another just as long. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Mark?
Good. I'm doing great, Scott. It's great to be back on the program. Things are looking up for the new year, 2015.
All right. Well, I sure like your sunny optimism. And your latest essay is good news. So good. But I'm sorry, and there's so much we got to cover on the show today. But I got to start with this biggest and most important news going on right now, and that is the completely – oh, and sorry for no warning for this, but I bet you have something to say. The crash in the price of oil. Now, Peter Schiff says, well, that's just because it's the end of QE, and it's just like the coming stock market and housing bubble crashes. It's just the energy market crash first, that's all. And then there are others who are saying, oh, no, this is just like in the Reagan years. The Americans are conspiring with the Saudis to stick it to the Iranians and especially the Russians by dumping the price of oil through the floor. And then others say, nah, it's just because all the fracking, all that extra oil and natural gas is coming online and hitting the global markets and this and that and the other thing. And I wonder whether you have a favorite explanation or if you have a different one or if you want to mix them up or what do you think?
Well, Scott, that's an incredibly important question. All three of those factors are probably playing some role, but the way I look at it is the price of oil is like the barometer for the global economy. And so the most important thing to know about the crash in the price of oil is that it indicates clearly and globally that the world economy is slowing down. And it's easy to make the case that this is the most important explanation because the Chinese economy is slowing down and the latest reports have been even worse than anticipated. The Japanese economy is faring badly under Abenomics and is in contraction or recession. The European economy is in shreds, and most of the countries in Europe are either in recession or teetering on recession. And then, of course, there's contractions in Brazil. There's contractions in South American countries. There's, you know, the United States has done fine the last couple reporting periods in terms of GDP growth. But if you look at the global economy, it's a sure sign that the global economy is in contraction, and a slight contraction in the economy means a significant change in the demand for oil. And so, you know, with oil supply in the short run, it's very inelastic. And so you see this big drop off in prices. So the Saudis may be conspiring in some sort. They have a very low cost of production versus countries like Russia. And so there may be some conspiracy going on there. And yes, the end of QE2 will add to the at least slowdown in GDP growth. But ultimately, this is probably in the longer run a sign that the economy is going through its contraction, its, you know, what they call recession is a correction phase in the Austrian eyes, where the bad investments, the bubble activities are extinguished and resources are freed up for production and services where consumers want them, not where central bankers want them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I got a bunch of questions, but I don't want to head too far down that path. So we'll just leave that right there for now and change the subject back to the drugs here. You have this great article coming out at Mises.org. The sky is not falling. Recreational pot turns one in Colorado. So come on with it. Tell us the horror.
Well, you know, of course, a lot of people predicted that things were going to go drastically wrong in Colorado, that there would be an epidemic of use and abuse, that, you know, pot would fall into the hands of every school child. The companies would abandon Colorado, that it would give Colorado a bad name and a black eye. And, of course, nothing like that has happened. The people of Colorado have embraced legal recreational marijuana, and everybody really is benefiting. Thousands of people are not being arrested and are not going to jail. Dozens of families have moved to Colorado so that they have access to medical marijuana without any constraints. There has been no dire consequences. There's been a couple of anecdotes regarding edible marijuana, which if you're not really experienced with edible marijuana, it's very easy to consume too much because you're not smoking it. And edible marijuana is more, in the longer term, it's more potent because you absorb all of the THC in the marijuana, whereas when you smoke it, a lot of it is wasted. And so there was one fellow who, instead of eating one cookie, ate all six cookies and freaked out and jumped off of a hotel and was killed. There's another anecdote where a dog ate the owner's brownies off of the table and died as a result. And so Coloradans have quickly adapted to those circumstances, and they're taking precautions, and the producers are putting warning labels on them and packaging them in single-use packages. Of course, the government's getting revenue from this, and so it seems like everybody is pretty happy, and the polls indicate that the people who voted for legal marijuana still strongly support it, and even those who voted against legalizing marijuana now realize that just like alcohol prohibition in the 1920s, it's really stupid to try to outlaw something like this. And they're realizing that this guy hasn't fallen in, and so they're very happy with it. So support for legal recreational marijuana has actually increased. And, of course, it's very, very strong for medical marijuana being legal, both in Colorado and across the country. There's a supermajority now that supports legalizing medical marijuana, except in the most senior age groups or demographics.
Mm-hmm. In other words, the people who really have no experience with it whatsoever and only know from the scare stories and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, these are people who grew up in an age, who were born in an age when the Reefer Madness campaign by the federal government, you know, first of all, they called it, you know, marijuana and reefer rather than cannabis, which was a product that was being sold in pharmacies during those days and used by most households in various medical preparations, veterinary medical preparations and so forth. They demonized marijuana in those early days. They said that initially the government claimed that it could kill you, that it could drive you insane, and that it would make you violent. And then, of course, experience over time, people in the 60s and 70s realized, A, it didn't kill you, B, it didn't drive you insane, and C, it didn't make you violent. It made you very docile and happy. And so all of those lies about marijuana are only still affecting those senior age groups. And basically everybody else says it's okay. It's a drug, though. I mean, it still has dangers associated with it. Yeah. You shouldn't operate mechanical activities and so forth, but it's a great thing otherwise to have it legalized.
Hold it right there. We got to take this break. We'll be right back with everybody, and with Mark Thornton right after this. Mises.org, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking with Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which I can never say right. Oh, yeah, just Mises. It's the Mises Institute, because everybody can say that. Like, I hate Mises to pieces, only love instead. Okay. Mark Thornton, he's the author of a book, The Economics of Prohibition, of course, from as free market as you can possibly get of a point of view here. And we're talking about the decriminalization, legalization with much regulation of pot for the last year in Colorado and the results. And you mentioned this, the scare story of the kid that jumped from the balcony, which reminds me of a Bill Hicks joke that I can't play because of all the cussing in it, but where he says, hey, don't go blaming acid, because that's the same story you hear about acid all the time. Don't go blaming acid on this guy. If he thought he could fly, he should have taken off from the ground and checked it out first. You don't see a duck take an elevator up to the roof and jump off to try to fly for the first time. So, you know, one less doorknob in the world. Oh, well. But anyway, sorry. These things do happen. And yes, it's true that probably someone who has no experience with pot should not eat a whole lot of it at first. That would be like if you've never drank before and going for chugging a bottle of the strongest liquor instead of, you know, warming up with a couple of beers or something. But anyway, as you said, this is the best that anybody can come up with as a downside, right, other than with the states next door are complaining because they still want to keep it illegal and yet the supply has gone up and the price down in neighboring states. They're kind of throwing a fit, huh?
Yes. I mean, the neighboring states, you know, they're complaining that they're finding more people crossing from Colorado into their states and they're arresting them with marijuana smuggling charges. And the main reason they're catching more people is that they're really cracking down at the border. And so if you're in Colorado and you're leaving the state, you know, if whether it's Oklahoma, Nebraska, New Mexico, and so forth, they're pretty much on alert about, you know, people trying to smuggle marijuana. So there's really not an increase in smuggling. It's more of an increase in them trying to catch smugglers that has resulted in right. those stories. And there's a funny anecdote at the Denver airport. There's a special bin near all of the entrances where you can throw away your marijuana before you get go through the checkout and the security check. And my brother just went through there recently, and he asked the guy, he said, how much marijuana have you collected through these bins? And he said, none, of course, because nobody's going to be carrying marijuana into the airport and then taking it out of their pocket and putting it into, you know, a barrel with federal security agents looking at them. So it's really not an increase so much as they're cracking down at the border. And that's the real story. It's, you know, and there are stories being planted in the media by the White House Drug Office, which constructed a report recently. It's like 150 pages where they try to say that the sky is falling. For example, they said that there's been a 30% increase in high school students who've been expelled for drug issues. Of course, that's not necessarily marijuana issues, but the points in time before and after the study, they failed to point out that there was also a 30% increase in the number of high school students. And so the report is misleading at every important juncture that they try to show. Like, for example, they said that there was a 100% increase in the number of traffic fatalities before versus after drug legalization. But what they failed to show was that in the year that they used as the starting point, which was 2006, only 40% of traffic fatalities were tested for marijuana. And in the after year, the traffic fatalities, 100% of them were tested for marijuana being present in the body of the deceased. Mm-hmm. So in reality, they should have shown, if everything had stayed the same, that there was a 120% increase in marijuana involved in traffic fatality. So, you know, that federal White House report which didn't even show that it was really from the White House, is completely misleading and does not show, as far as I could tell, any sky is falling type statistics, basically.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Are there any interest groups in America who really support the war on pot? I mean, the war on harder drugs, that's not even really up for discussion at this point. But the war on pot, I know that there are police unions and probably, you know, the arms manufacturers who sell guns to cops on government contracts, giant welfare payments for them, the iron bar and concrete companies that build the prisons and the corporations that administer them, those kinds of, you know, very connected, corrupt, conflict of interest type interests. But what about the concerned Republican wives of America who just want to keep their little babies safe from the pot? I mean, do they have a group to pressure to keep it against the law? Or is it simply just the police unions and their cronies at this point?
Well, certainly the police unions. Most importantly, it's the private prison industry that backs and spends lots of money lobbying for long prison terms. You know, surprise, surprise, because they're raking in $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year per prisoner. So as they add people to the prisons, just consumers sometimes get thrown in prison for long prison sentences. And so that's a big interest group. There's also, of course, the alcoholic beverage industry. They see, and to a certain extent, there's been indications from the tobacco industry that they financially support efforts that oppose drug legalization. So we can see in some cases these interest groups directly contributing to the campaigns against liberty and against legalization of marijuana, medical marijuana, decriminalization efforts. So they're definitely financially involved, and they come out sometimes, like in California, Proposition 19, the Beer Distributors Association came out and said that they were worried that their drivers might be driving these heavy, dangerous trucks around while being stoned, which of course is ludicrous because companies can prevent their employees from drinking or smoking marijuana or taking heroin or cocaine while on the job or even not on the job. And then very often these financial interests funnel money to religious groups and nebulously sounding groups that, you know, support quote unquote the public interest in keeping drugs illegal. So you'll very often find, if you follow the money, you'll see that money is supporting, opposing marijuana legalization, and they're very often funneling it to religious leaders who then, you know, tell their followers and make TV and radio ads to fight this effort for liberty in this country, Scott. And so, you know, that's really the main opposition, is that they create stories, horror stories, and they finance putting ads on the air and on television to fight these efforts to legalize marijuana.
You know what, though? That sounds like a big no. There is no real concerned mom group, like even Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There may have been some other interest behind that, but it started with just moms of dead, innocent people kind of a thing. We really don't have any kind of honest grassroots, not that they would have the authority to pass laws like this in my libertarian world or anything, but it just, there is no interest that's not a conflict of interest on this case, it doesn't sound like.
There's real people who don't know the situation and who are swayed by these ads.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that. I've seen that up close and personal.
Sure.
But no real public interest group. Yeah. That I've seen or that I've been made aware of through these different campaigns in the various states.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry, because I wanted to get back to some of the history here and talk about FDR and all that, like I promised you the last time we spoke. But to wrap up here real quick, I wonder whether you've seen many statements, obviously not the police unions, but I wonder whether you've seen many statements by just regular cops or sheriffs saying, oh, yeah, you know what? It turned out this really was a good idea, and now we can focus on chasing criminals and that kind of thing.
Oh, no. There's a lot of law enforcement agents that support legalizing marijuana. There's a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And so, you know, cops will tell you that, you know, in terms of violent altercations with citizens, that they see them all the time involving alcohol, but they never see them when it's just marijuana consumption.
And I'm sorry, I didn't really phrase that right. I guess what I really meant was Colorado cops in the last year saying that, hey, you know, this turned out to not be that bad of a thing as a, you know, they may have been opposed to it before or concerned about it before.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who have, you know, in the polling data that, you know, admitted that they were wrong. They interviewed a cop. They interviewed somebody who was drastically opposed to legalization and then said, you know, I should have known better because of what happened during and after alcohol prohibition. Things turned out much better. And there's, I think there's more mothers that are concerned about their children, not about the drugs themselves, but about all of the violence and criminality that drug prohibition has created and the state of fear that exists in inner city public schools and the destruction to families, particularly in the African American community, that they've bumped into, that they've come into contact with, and they all of a sudden they realize, geez, people smoking pot is probably a lot better than kids being killed, than kids being terrorized in public schools, that kids dying in Chicago as a result of drive-by shootings, of, you know, black African-American families being broken up with the breadwinner thrown in prison for 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, the kids in juvie too, man. That can be really hard on somebody when they're 14 years old.
Oh, yeah, it's a life-changing, not for the benefit usually, situation. And, you know, and children are exempt from obviously going to federal prisons and things like that. But, you know, ending up as a result of broken families and the war on drugs and committing petty crimes and being caught with possession of marijuana and so forth, you know, it does everything from putting you in juvenile hall to making you ineligible for student loans. You know, so it ruins your career, it ruins your life, it ruins your education, and more people are seeing that. They're arresting hundreds of thousands of people until this recent, you know, wave of drug marijuana legalization and decriminalization. Now more than 50% of Americans can't be thrown in jail as a result of marijuana consumption. So that's why I think that's the one bright light that we see on a horizon that is otherwise dark with government, with war, with inflation, you know, with terrorizing the citizens, with you have a militarized police force, police killing innocent citizens for no good reason. All of that darkness, we can see the one light of liberty shining through where the American citizens themselves have gotten up, they've gone to the polls, and they've said, legalize marijuana. We don't care if it's a federal crime. We don't care if it's an international crime and an international agreement. We don't care. We're not putting up with it. And if the feds intervene, we're going to go to the polls and vote all of those turds out of office as well. So it's a one good sign, and I think that if Americans realize that they can make a change at the local and state level to stand up to this federal Leviathan and put it in its place, Scott. And you know, that's what you do every day, I'm sure, with your show, and that's a great thing, and that's why I love to come on it.
Yeah, well, I think you're right that the proof is just right in front of everybody's face. It's undeniable, and hopefully it'll be seen as more and more of kind of a juggernaut. You know, I don't want to say a snowball rolling downhill, because that usually has a negative connotation, but it does seem to it's undeniable, right? Ever since the first medical marijuana legalization in California, there's just been no stopping it for the last, you know, I don't know, 20 years now. So
nullification is a great thing, and Americans are hopefully learning that lesson, that they can nullify federal laws, they can kick the feds out, and stand up to these international agreements and international crime that the U.S. has been leading this international war on drugs. And so I think it's a great thing.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming back on the show, Mark. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. I love being on this program. It's one of the great shows on the Internet, and it does play such a vital role. I just want to thank you for what you do.
Well, very nice of you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's Mark Thornton. He is senior fellow at the Mises Institute. That's Mises.org, author of The Economics of Prohibition. We'll be right back with Frank Ledwidge in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. That Onion Radio News, it's a hit or a miss kind of a thing, huh? Well, anyway. All right. It's the Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Frank Ledwidge, and he was British military intelligence in every war since the Balkans in 1996, and was even part of the Iraq Survey Group hunting for non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And he's written, I think, a book or two about Afghanistan. And all I know is I read a review in the London Review of Books of four different books. You might have heard me mention this to Eric Margulies on the show last week. Four different books about Britain's role in the Afghan War by James Meek, who's not James Gordon Meek, our investigative reporter friend. He's a different James Meek. And it's called, this is called Worse Than a Defeat. Worse Than a Defeat. It's a review of these four books, and Frank's book is called Investment in Blood, The True Cost of Britain's Afghan War. Welcome to the show, Frank. How are you doing?
Scott, it's a privilege to be with you, and Happy New Year to you.
Very happy to have you on the show here. And so, I guess, first of all, can you tell us about exactly your role in the Afghan War as a government official and as a journalist there?
Well, in 2007, I was recruited. They contacted me and said, we're looking for somebody to advise on the justice system. Now, in my military career, I was a reservist. In my real life, I was a what I suppose you might call an international human rights lawyer, although there's many thousands of those around. And they really couldn't find anybody else with a relevant combination of experience. I'd done some work in former Soviet Union. I'd been in Iraq as a military officer, as you mentioned. So I got hauled into this, what turned out to be a completely misconceived mission in the south of Afghanistan, in Helmand, as the justice advisor to the provincial reconstruction team there, with the brief to provide a better deal, I quote, a better deal to the people of Helmand than the Taliban could offer, which was, of course, as most people know, and hiding to nothing, and nothing is, of course, what we achieved there. I was only there for about 6 months or so, and out of that, it was fairly clear which direction things were going.
And so, I guess, really, Britain's—we're talking about mostly or all post-Obama, and then the McChrystal Petraeus surge into Afghanistan, correct?
Yeah.
And then, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct, Scott. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then so the British role there was virtually all in Helmand Province, or more than that?
No, pretty much Helmand, 95% or so. There were some special forces knocking around the country doing the death squad stuff, mm-hmm. with JSOC, I think. I don't know anything about that from my own knowledge. I've just read the excellent work of Jeremy Scahill and whatnot on that, mm-hmm. but. No, 95% of our effort was Helmand. And in the end, what happened, the British found they were essentially beaten by the Taliban, found themselves discomforted, out of sorts, and had to call in the US Marines to bail them out in 2009, which, of course, had very limited effect overall, but at least had the effect, had the had the initial effect of relieving the pressure and the embarrassment on the British Army.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned, this review draws from your work as well as three other books, and you know it's all kind of the same story mixed up here, the way it's told. But I think a big part of nothing surprising in here, but something that I learned in here was just kind of the unreality of the mission as stated versus the tactics and the strategy. The counterinsurgency doctrine, as it played out, it sounds like, well, they had this idea of what to do, and then, but they didn't even really try to do it. Not that it would have worked anyway, but it seems like actually doing the counterinsurgency doctrine that they described was an entirely different thing than what they even attempted to implement on the ground there. Am I right about that?
Yeah. You know, one thing that it's worth your listeners and indeed anybody else who's thinking about getting themselves involved in invading other countries is that you should really have some idea of what's going on in the country outside the wires in which you're going to live. And the trouble with the military who dominated this campaign, you know, at all levels. I mean, there's all this talk of civilian surge from, 2010 onwards, McChrystal, and then later, of course, Petraeus and all that nonsense. The whole thing was a military dominate. And the problem with the military, your military, our military, any Western armies, is that basically they live at home. They live very cosseted lives within extremely confined circumstances, extremely secure, self-referential, self-selecting lives. And that world is then transmuted to environments which are obviously outside the wire entirely different, but not too much changes inside the wires. So it's very easy for people like that, you know, with the best will in the world, and these, you know, they're excellent at resisting the Third Soviet Shock Army or, you know, destroying the Republican Guard in a few weeks. But when it comes to understanding what people outside the wire, even in their own country, let alone in a place which could not be more different like Afghanistan, you know, they're at sea, really. And so what they do is they impose their own reality, which they call counterinsurgency, which to me is a bit like a, you know, one of these orthodoxies, a bit like the Catholic Orthodox in the Middle Ages. Everyone was required to accept this, and if you didn't, you were a heretic. There are holy texts which one should read, and you know you've discussed these before on your program. They're to be accepted. There are prophets, the likes of John Nagel, or the sort of great Messiah himself, Petraeus. All this is recited constantly. The British experience in Malaya, until, of course, it all went south in Iraq and then in Helmand, where I was involved in both of those, of course. And unfortunately, none of that bears any relevance whatsoever to what people think outside those wires.
Yeah. Well, now, so I wonder about that. I mean, is it just like Catch-22? And I don't mean the Catch-22, but I mean in the book where the entire structure of the military is just so stupid, where no one who tells the guy above him anything succeeds in actually teaching the guy above him anything. That it's just, the whole thing is that absurd. Because it seems to me from here that Petraeus and McChrystal and some of these guys, when no one's around, they've got to be whispering to each other that they know they're lying. I mean, come on. They're not fighting the Taliban, as it says in here. They're fighting whatever local Pashtuns in the Helmand district dare to resist them. That's all they're fighting, and they've got to know that. And so how in the hell are they protecting these people from themselves when themselves are the ones that they're killing? You know?
Yeah.
It makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, we were there under this shibboleth of protecting the people. Now, against whom we were protecting the people wasn't entirely clear, but certainly the people themselves regarded us as the major threat, or a major threat, and with some very, very good cause. You know, in Helmand alone, the British and American forces killed way over 1,000 civilians, very few of whom were reported in the international or the state medias of the relevant countries. Way over 1,000 people who weren't involved in the campaign. And thousands of people who we called Taliban, and as you correctly state there, were actually just local lads who were, you know, trying to defend themselves. Now, there were some efforts to make senior command understand this. I do think that a lot of the more astute people, and I'd count McChrystal amongst that in fairness, were probably aware of that. But, you know, the dominant story was we were there to fight the Taliban, who were somehow connected with Al-Qaeda, and somehow that would all keep us safe. And to try and roll that back was really, if you were going to try and roll that back from a fairly low level, like the kind, the sort of level that me or Matthew Ho or other British folk like Michael Martin, who's one of the heroic people who wrote I won't call it a whistleblowing book, a truth-telling book, reviewed in your James Meek article. You know, if you were going to try that from our level, it wasn't going to work.
Right. All right. Well, we got to stop here for the break. We'll be right back, everybody, with more with Frank Ledwidge. He's the author of this book, Investment in Blood, The True Cost of Britain's Afghan War. It's reviewed by James Meek in the London Review of Books, if you want to check that out. We'll be right back. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Again, Happy New Year to everybody, especially if you're just tuning in and didn't get to hear me say that earlier. I'm talking with Frank Ledwidge. He's a former lots of things. Well, he's a lawyer and military intelligence officer, reservist there in the British Army, and was part of the Iraq survey group, not finding warehouses full of VX gas in Iraq. And he's written this book about the war in Afghanistan, Investment in Blood, The True Cost of Britain's Afghan War. Frank Ledwidge, again, is his name. And the book is reviewed by James Meek here in the London Review of Books. Worse Than a Defeat is the title there at lrb.co.uk. And so we're talking about the unreality of the counterinsurgency doctrine, you know, as proposed in the halls of power, compared to how it's implemented on the ground. And the thing of it is that everybody knew it was a giant joke. Everybody knew that the surge in Iraq was just a PR stunt rather than anything that actually so-called worked there, helping the majority finish taking the capital city from the minority. Yeah, great big accomplishment. You didn't need a counterinsurgency doctrine to accomplish that. That's just helping one side win a civil war is all. Clear, hold, and build, nothing. It's the Bada Brigade doing the holding and the building, not the American Army there. And then so to replicate that in Afghanistan, a lot of people said it was a joke at the time. Michael Hastings was certainly reporting in Rolling Stone and talking about on this show how all the army soldiers at the time, they thought the whole thing was a joke. Morale was absolutely at the lowest. They were told to stand around and act like traffic cops getting sniped at, as though we're officer friendly here to protect you, while the Delta Force and the Navy SEALs come to kill you in the middle of the night, which is completely just the whole thing. So my question, there's a question. The question, Frank, is weren't they just lying? And wasn't the whole game just making money and collecting ribbons for their little green shirts and acting, you know, like important people and cashing in on opium trades? Got to have something to do with intelligence agencies and military officers occupying this country for 15 years with the most black market drugs coming out of there. As have come out of any place ever in world history. Weren't they just scamming us, adding time to the Washington clock, to the London clock, as they call it, conniving the politicians and the people into letting them stay longer so they can lose later?
Well, you know, a lot of people did believe in this nonsense. Particularly, not only actually in the military, the medium, lower levels, you know, people will tend in the military to believe what they're told. They don't have any evidence to the contrary. And if evidence in the form of snipers or IEDs comes their way, then they'll rationalize that as, you know, the kind of resistance they were told they were going to have in this mission, that somebody else knows what they're doing. And there's this constant idea in the military that somebody else knows what they're doing. And I saw this in Bosnia. I thought, well, somebody must know what it's about. And there it was, things went all right. When we got to Iraq, I remember a close friend of mine who spoke Arabic saying, you know, somebody must know what's going on. I said, yeah, somebody should. We were sitting by the Shatt al-Arab in Iraq at the time, and he said, most people think we're the guys that should know what's going on, Frank. And I said, yeah, but we don't have a clue, do we, Frank? We have no clue what's going on here, no. When I got to Afghanistan, I was one of those people that should have known what was going on. I was one of these civilian advisors at the highest, you know, fairly pretty much at the highest levels with access to the top people. We hadn't a clue what we were doing. Not a damn one of us. We lived our own little life there in the fort in Lashkargah, which was quite rightly the civilian part of it, known by the soldiers, or quite amusingly, I thought, as Las Vegas, because we lived a completely different life from the soldiers. There were believers in this. But of course, ultimately, as you say, the whole thing was a complete scam because it was found misfounded intellectually. Now, whether people were scamming this or, you know, gaining shed loads of money on the opium trade, I don't know. I think probably there were. I didn't know anybody who were. Those may have been more on the sort of private security side. But, I mean, the whole thing was a complete nonsense. And I think we'll look back at it as just a sort of hand-wringing, tragic mistake.
Hmm. And now, I guess part of that, and that's told in this review here too, is the slightest reminder of Britain's history in Afghanistan. You know, the Americans look at the Brits like, hey, junior partner, special relationship, come and help us. Unlike Israel, at least you come and fight wars with us when we need you to, you know, as far as being our special relationship, world's best ally and all that kind of thing. But the Americans had no idea that this is a giant albatross around our neck. If we're really trying to get the people of Afghanistan to like us, bringing the Brits with us is the worst PR in the history of that you could possibly think of, right?
Yeah, totally. I remember a good friend of mine called Jean McKenzie, who's a well-known journalist who's working there for years. She came to visit us in the PRT once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Jean.
Yeah, she's a great woman and a good friend. Anyway, she came in and we had a coffee there in the little canteen. And I said, what do people think of us out there? And she said, oh, they hate you. No, I said, that can't be true, because I drunk this ridiculous Kool-Aid. That can't be true. Why do they hate us? Well, she said, you need to know a few basics. First of all, the only place on the planet where you would be less welcome, where the British Army would be less welcome, is the Bogside in Londonderry. You have a history here of four wars, this being the fourth. In each case, you were seen as rapacious invaders coming here for your own benefit. And furthermore, she said, this, not 100 miles from here, is where your worst defeat in Afghan eyes took place. You could not have come to a more hostile environment and a more anti-British environment on the planet than Helmand. Now, did anybody know that when we went in there? No, because nobody bothered to look at the history of the place. And of course, we all knew, we the British, you see, we're really good. One thing we can do, huh, not like those Americans, is counterinsurgency. You see, we can teach them what that's all about. And this is a perfect opportunity to show those Americans what we're about. Right. And as for the, you know, you mentioned there.
And meanwhile, you're just as welcome as if you were invading South Carolina again.
Yeah, that's well, at least in South Carolina, you'd have people speaking the same language and they could tell you they hated you to your face. Nobody, needless to say, amongst us spoke the local languages, and we had to rely on interpreters who were, let's say, of varying quality. I used to find myself speaking my rubbish Russian to people because, of course, the one thing the Soviets had left was a legacy of education and loads of people who spoke Russian. Because for us, when we used to select people to go on the little 2-week courses, rubbishy little courses we'd run for, you know, policemen or lawyers or whatever in Kabul, the Soviets would say, right, we're going to select you. We're going to take you to Kiev or Murmansk or, you know, Samarkand, and you're going to stay there, or Moscow. You'll stay there for 3 years. We'll teach you Russian and we'll qualify you professionally. And they did it to tens and tens of thousands of people. It was pathetic, the sort of nonsense that we were promulgating there.
Hmm. All right. Well, now, so we're about out of time. In fact, we'll have to go overtime into the break a little bit here. But I got to ask you what you think is happening now, because I guess all the Brits have left now or are leaving. But the Americans are staying, and they can't call it a defeat as long as they're still there. That's the lesson that they've taken from the Iraq War, I guess. And so, but what do you think is going to happen? Is it just going to be the status quo, or do you see the Taliban coming back to prominence? And I mean the actual Taliban, not anybody who would dare resist definition. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, insofar as my views informed, it looks to me the way that the South is going is the way it was before we got there. You know, the negotiations between what they call the Asli Taliban, which is the guy, you know, the Mullah Omar, real Taliban, drugs gangs, local tribal groups, you know, that sort of melange of rivalries and hostilities and mini wars that have been going on there for certainly the last 40 years and actually from, you know, hundreds of years beyond that. And that's the way it is. And right now, with the government just being one of these little gangs. Will the Taliban come back to power, Asli Taliban? Unlikely. But, you know, what will happen, certainly, is that their constituency will be adopted into the government in one form or another, as it should be. They represent, whether we like it or not, a considerable body of opinion in the country. And that opinion should be allowed for, whether we like it or not. And it will be in due course.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Frank. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Real pleasure.
All right, so that's Frank Ledwidge and his book, Investment in Blood, The True Cost of Britain's Afghan War. Well, it's in my Amazon cart now, and it's reviewed by James Meek here at lrb.co.uk. And the article is called Worse Than a Defeat. And we'll be right back with Bell True on Libya right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right. Oh, good. There, she is back online. Hey, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, and I'm failing to reach Bell True. You know what? I guess it was one step short of confirmed, wasn't it, that interview? Boy, it looks like she just hit the no button on me. Oh, geez. Okay. I guess I'll try again another time. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm kind of glad because I got so much news to cover and I was going to be all sad and depressed that I didn't have a chance to cover it. So here, I have a chance. First of all, the F-35. This thing, it's almost unreal what a piece of junk this thing is. The F-35, supposedly it's supposed to do everything. It does nothing. It's not stealthy. It's not fast. It can't turn well in a dogfight. It can't carry very many weapons because of its attempted stealthiness. You can't fly it in the rain. You can't store its fuel anywhere where it's warm outside. Can't fly it anywhere near any kind of storm. Say a lightning storm without rain? Nope, those are also banned. No lightning. You know, in the sky. You can't have lightning in the sky if you're going to fly one of these jets around. And the nose camera doesn't work. Can't identify anything on the ground. Can't laser a target. Can't do anything. Now, the machine gun doesn't work, and they don't know why. It's the same damn Vulcan cannon as always, right, guys? And yet, something is wrong with the software, and they say it's going to take them years to go through and find the bug in the software to make the machine gun fire. That'll be in 2019. And let's see. They've landed one on a carrier once, as far as I know. Anyway, the thing's a complete piece of crap. And they've spent trillions, I believe, certainly more than $1 trillion. I think more than $2 trillion so far on these things, on the development and on each one. And so, you know, we've had jump jets for 40 years. So we're not, should we be that impressed that some versions of them can take off vertically? When it's otherwise still a complete piece of crap outmatched by the jets that it's replacing. And meanwhile, a single fleet of F-16s and F-15s can dominate the airspace over any nation on the planet, including Russia if it came down to it, although, you know, they could launch nukes into the air and stuff, I guess. I don't know. And they got some anti-aircraft. They've got some MiGs. But they would, it would be a matter of volume. If you think the F-22 and the F-35 are going to swoop in and make the technological edge, you're joking. All they needed to do was improve the electronics in the F-15s and 16s. They'd be fine. The F-18s for the Navy. And anyway, the whole point, and this is actually a quote from the designer of the F-16 and the F-15. He said the purpose of the F-35 is to take your money. The purpose of the F-35 is not to be stealthy, is not to be fast, is not to be maneuverable, is not to be any of the things that it claims to be able to do and cannot do. It's not meant to be able to fly in the rain. It's meant to take money from you. That's all. That's what's wrong with America, don't you see? Empire. The military-industrial complex. It would be a crazy conspiracy theory, except the term was coined by the Supreme Allied Commander of the effort against the Nazis in Europe in World War II, and then later President of the United States for 8 years, Republican Dwight David Eisenhower. 5-star. Because he said, hey, look, the executive branch doles out all this money to these companies, and these companies put a little bit of that money back into the Congress, who votes to give them larger and larger shares of the budget. And he knew from being president, there is no limit on the appetite of the military services for how many men they want, how much equipment they want, and when they want it. No limit. And it was all he could do with all the power, all the political capital he had of being Dwight Eisenhower, to be able to tell the Army no about anything. And yeah, it's a thing. It's the shape of the American economy. It's the great deformation, as David Stockman calls it. Yeah, that's what it is. And as Nick Tursus pointed out in his great book, The Complex, it doesn't make sense to use hyphens anymore. It's just the complex. It's the entire economy is distorted this way. It's the military, industrial, congressional, banking, media, scientific, research, academia, tube socks and tires and guns and everything complex. Everything complex. If you have a company and you're not seeking some kind of military contract for whatever it is you're hawking, then you're losing out. That's where the giant profits are made. Government work, where close enough is close enough. And nobody's responsible because it's not their money. And so our entire economy is massively distorted. And never even mind that when you look at the distortions in the housing market and the stock market, all of that is driven by inflation, which is driven by the need for the government to make the empire seem free. Even if they want to have a bonus war, they want to have an extra war. They're going to have a war in Libya on the margin. And you're not even going to notice. I've had people say to me, there was a war in Libya? Yeah, the year 2011. Would you sleep through it? No, they didn't sleep through it, but it was just a marginal kind of a side issue sort of a war. And yeah, the Americans paid for it and supplied all the weapons for it, but the French and the British did most of the bombing after the first few days, and American Special Forces and whatever on the ground. But it was just a little bit of a Kosovo kind of a war, the kind of thing that barely catches the American people's attention. And why? Because they don't have to pay for it, they don't think. But the giant boom that ends up in, as the definition Mark Thornton explained on the show earlier, Mr. Austrian Economics explained, the crash is the correction back to reality from artificially high prices. So you're looking at, a housing bubble distortion or stock market bubble distortion or whatever else it is in your sector of the economy or the one you wish you were in. It's most of that is all driven by the need to make empire seem cheap. And so we all suffer the boom and the bust that way. That's what's wrong with America. That's why for decades on end, the American people have answered that America is on the wrong track. Yeah, that's because it's supposed to be a limited temporary constitutional republic. The government is, not the country. The government is supposed to be a limited republican form of government with a rule of law and a president who is merely a civilian citizen like everyone else, subject to the rule of law just like everyone else. Chief executive of departments created by Congress, not commander-in-chief of the world empire in the place of the British. That's the wrong track we're on. You can tell. The F-35 is just the poster boy, right? How in the hell is this even a project? When they came up with the idea back when the USSR still existed, 30 years ago.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, y'all, I'm Scott. Well, I'm sorry I was not able to bring y'all a Beltrú interview. I thought I was going to. I'm going to try to see if I can get her on sometime next week. And also, I'm shooting for Reese Ehrlich for the KPFK show. He's got a great one. I forget if it's on antiwar.com today or if it was yesterday. The newer, it was yesterday's spotlight over the weekend there, over New Year's. The new Iraq war is doomed. By Reese Ehrlich. And I really like this guy. In fact, first time I ever met him or heard of him, he was on a panel. I was on a panel with him, really. It was his panel. He gave a talk, and then there was a panel afterwards, and it was about Iran, and it was me and him and a student and a neocon. And, it was a lot of fun. It was back in 2010, about Iran's nuclear program mostly. You can find it on YouTube. Iran panel, use my name in Iran panel, Reese Ehrlich, something. And you can find the whole thing on there, 2.5 hour long thing with Reese Ehrlich's talk and all that. But it turns out this guy's written a mess of books about this. Oh, and it also turns out that Eric Garris from antiwar.com knows him from way back, from I think the old Peace and Freedom Party days, which was a leftist libertarian coalition back in the 70s. But anyway, Reese Ehrlich. And every time I talk to the guy, I think to myself, wow, this guy really knows what the hell he's talking about. I think on the level of Coburn almost. He's really good, man. And he spends a lot of time in these war zones reporting from them for real. So, I'm going to try to have him for the KPFK show on Sunday. And, this piece was a really great one. The new Iraq war is doomed. And just shaking my head, man. And here, I'll try to keep this brief. Iraq in 2014, 48,590 killed and 26,516 wounded. This is by Margaret Griffiths at antiwar.com. You won't find these numbers anywhere else. There are others who are publishing, portions of these, but she's double-checking them and adding them up. And her job has been for years now just keeping track of as many reported deaths as possible, especially, confirming them as best you can, and keeping track of Iraq war casualties as it still rages on. And so in this last year, 48,590 killed, 26,516 wounded, 76,000 estimated killed, in the Syrian war. This is it's the same war. 76,000 killed in the western part of this war. And that includes both sides. Let's see, the observatory broke down their figures by faction, showing no group was particularly spared in the conflict, finding 22,627 killed were soldiers or members of pro-government militias, with 17,000 hardcore Islamists slain, 15,000 from more moderate rebel factions. I don't know what that means. And 17,790 civilians. Yeah, lots of aerial bombardment and that kind of thing. Horrible war there. And then these go together. Oh, I guess I X'd it out. But it was Obama again saying that we will not allow a terrorist safe haven in Iraq, which that is a Gulf of Tonkin resolution type of statement right there that provides for endless war. I mean, what does that mean other than no Sunnis with guns allowed anywhere or something? No Sunni Arabs. Or they can own a gun, but they can't wave it over their head. Obama envoy John Allen. That's General John Allen. Quote, no short-term solutions for stopping the Islamic State. And he gave an interview to Der Spiegel, and I admit I hadn't read it yet. But there it is in Der Spiegel. That's spiegel.de. U.S. envoy warns no short-term solutions for stopping the Islamic State. And it's just like I've been telling you all along. Nobody's going to be able to rouse these guys from claiming Raqqa and Mosul other than the U.S. Marine Corps. I don't think the Peshmerga will even try it. And some of them talk tough, but they just want money and guns. I don't even think they're going to try it. And I guess it's possible that the Peshmerga, with a lot of American air power and some special forces, could go in there and blast the hell out of the Islamic State and take over Mosul for a time. But I don't know. And even then, they'd simply be turning the Islamic State back into an insurgency again, and hardly guaranteeing its defeat. All they have to do is not lose, and all they have to do to not lose is not all die. And so, you know, you can go back in time and not murder Uday and Qusay, but otherwise, this is the world that you live in now. And ISIS forces are nearing those thousands of, quote, non-combat troops in the Anbar province right now. So this thing's heating up. And just to remind you whose side you're on, still, this whole time, since 2003, Iranian general killed by sniper fire in Iraq. He was advising the Iraqi troops in Samarra. And if I remember it right, Samarra is a more mixed city, Sunni and Shia. And there's the Samarra Mosque there is a very important Shia shrine. But I don't think that they really control the whole city. So that's kind of a permanent flashpoint. Zarqawi's bombing of the Samarra Mosque and repeated bombing of the Samarra Mosque in 2006 helped play into Donald Rumsfeld's sectarian war there. And the Ayatollah Khamenei. I don't mean to forget him, his role. But yeah. Anyway, and then another one from the great Jason Ditz at antiwar.com. Shiite militias redraw the map in central Iraq. It's just George W. Bush's fourth term, that's all. Fighting for the Ayatollah's Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, and the Ayatollah Sistani, his counterpart, living down there in Basra. And they're militias. That's who America serves in Iraq. That's who America's been serving in Iraq all this time. And now, good, I actually have a few minutes to change the subject to Russia here for a minute. And man, you know what? I'm so sorry that I was not able to interview Bell True for you guys today about Libya, but go and you can look at two or three or five foreignpolicy.com articles per month, or just clear your cookies, man. You know, go and look. They have a crappy paywall, but you can get around it if you're clever. A ground invasion of the capital is imminent. That's a quote from Haftar, talking about how he's going to sack Tripoli, and a very good write-up of the Libyan civil war, a really important piece in foreignpolicy.com by Bell True. A ground invasion of the capital is imminent is the title, and I'm going to try my best to get her on the show next week. Okay, so now Russia. Here's what I want you to know about Russia. And this will actually mark the first time I have ever said anything positive about Vladimir Putin, despite the fact that pretty much anyone will tell you that if you oppose America's policy against anyone, then you are therefore an apologist for whoever it is they're accusing, which is pretty blatantly ridiculous. But anyway, this is really important. And I gotta admit, I don't know all about it, but sure seems like some pretty damn incredible writing here. Now, so here's what it is. It's an article at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, called Examining the Hatred of Vladimir Putin and Russia, a Conservative Analysis by Boyd D. Cathy. And I'm going to try to get him on the show next week. And you can tell this guy's kind of a crunchy old paleo conservative. And so, but here he is, the point that I want to make, and there's a lot of points in this extremely long article, not all of which I agree with at all, but, Lynch, I gotta find, where's the first place he mentions this guy Lynch's name in here? I'm sorry, I could be better prepared, couldn't I? So there's this guy Lynch, why is that not highlighting there? Well, anyway. The hell is this book? Oh, it's here it is. It's he quotes the book and then he tells you the name of the book after a couple of quotes. That's not right. Editor, first person, an astonishingly frank self-portrait by Russia's President Vladimir Putin. And anyway, Professor Lynch is who he's quoting here. Sorry, I can't find the guy's name in the text while I'm scanning through it. You can read the damn article yourself. But here's the point. Remember when the communists tried to do a coup d'etat against Boris Yeltsin? And they failed. It was in August of 91. Oh, no, it was of Gorbachev. And it was the hardliners. Putin personally intervened, if I'm telling a damn story right here, and stopped the coup. He was the brake on the coup and protected the destruction of the Soviet Union. It was basically a faction fight within the KGB, and he was with the anti-communists who stuck with Yeltsin and Gorbachev and destroyed the USSR. It's at UNZ.com. Read it yourself. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.